Well, I think it's, I'm not sure I quite agree with your analysis, but that doesn't matter, because in England there was a similar but slightly different dynamic. Right from the start, the Gay Liberation Front in London was dominated by men. Not entirely white men, but largely men. There were a number of lesbians involved, and they were important members. There were one or two trans people involved. And for the first 2 years, the first 18 months, we all muddled through together with lots of tensions. But towards the end of the second year, the women actually formally left because they felt that the movement was too dominated by men and white men. And that was indeed the case. And many of the lesbians then got involved in the women's movement, or had already started to be involved in the women's movement, but in a sense moved their activism entirely into the women's movement. But some women always stayed within the Gay Liberation Front until it dissolved. And there have always been mixed groups in the Gay Liberation Movement in Britain. I have to say that there continued to be rows and disputes over many years about the dominance of men in the movement, about the resistance of men to change, about the difficulty of the movement, and this comes from men and women, of accepting trans people, difficulty of accepting bi people, bisexual people, because they weren't one thing or the other. This is the sort of argument that was put forward. So those tensions are always there. And I think they continue to survive in many of the LGBT organisations that exist today. I'm involved in an organisation called Opening Doors London. I'm chair of the trustees, the directors. We are an organisation for older LGBT people, and we have representatives of all elements of the LGBTQI coalition. But the fact is that most of the people who come regularly to meetings, two-thirds are men. And the women happily work with men on many things, but often feel the need to meet separately. But within one organisation, that always leads to tension, because some men object to women meeting separately from men. Some women don't like having men present at meetings. There's a whole question of trans people, of trans women. Are they really women? All these debates that you know exist in wider society around sexuality and gender exist even in the best intentioned small organisation. So we're not free of those tensions. It's an ongoing struggle, an ongoing conversation at best, and at worst it can be a sort of civil war. I like to think the organisation I'm involved has ways of managing this, but trying, and that's leaving aside of course the whole question of representation of minorities, and particularly minorities of colour, and faith minorities, the whole range. You're all familiar with the debates. And I don't think in a complex, pluralistic society, the gay world, the LGBT world, is bound to reflect that pluralism and the conflicts that sometimes arise from that. The Gay Liberation Movement, the Gay Liberation Front, had an existence that was very brief, both in New York and in London. The name survives in some quarters, and in London, in fact, in Britain, there's been a revival of the use of the name, encouraged by young militants. But historically, I think, the Gay Liberation Movement, Gay Liberation Front, represented a particular moment in LGBT history, where everyone, in a sense, felt they were part of the same struggle. But inevitably, there were different elements, different ideas, different ideologies, different beliefs. And within 2 years, there was a whole profusion in Britain of different organisations. There were socialist groupings, Marxist groupings, there were conservative groupings emerging, there were labour groupings, there were faith-based groups, Christian and later Muslim groups, Jewish groups. There was no natural affinity between them, except the fact that they were LGBTQ. And those terms which we use today, of course, were not used then. And the fact we use them today is itself a signal of profound changes and about the need both to affirm your individual identities, your individual sense of self as gay, lesbian, bi, trans, and also the need that people feel to work together in a sort of coalition of different identities. All of which raises the question, what do LGBTQI people have in common? What is it that links us? Because we don't necessarily have the same beliefs, we don't have the same social experiences, we don't necessarily have the same ethnic, racial backgrounds, we don't have the same faith backgrounds, we don't even desire the same things sexually or emotionally. So on the surface, at least, it seems an accident of history that we have things in common. I think the answer to my own question is we have two things in common. The first is we want to have something in common. We work to make something work in common. And we've done this over many years in different ways at different times. But that is about an act of collective will, an act of collective identification. But beyond that, I think it's something more profound that we don't easily see or talk about. And that is the fact that sexuality and gender are not personal preferences alone. They're not simply about private life. They are actually social experiences. Sexuality and gender are social structures, and they're social structures which include some and exclude others. And I think what unifies LGBT people, or whatever people want to call themselves, queer people, is a recognition that we're all, in a sense, created as outsiders, as different by the dominant sexual order, the dominant sexual structures, the dominant gender order. And sexuality and gender are very closely linked together. So there is a natural unity caused by the social structures within which we form our subjectivities and identities.